This webcast is a service of SDPB. Good, useful, and full of wonder. SDPB.
The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for argument this morning is Appeal Number 31143. State of South Dakota versus David Sangrew. Blue Bowen is arguing on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Sangrew, and Aaron Hanke is arguing on behalf of the state of South Dakota. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Bowen, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed at this time, Mr. Bowen.
My name is Bo Bluen, attorney with the South Dakota Office of Indigent Legal Services. I represent the defendant and appellant, David Sangrew Jr., in this matter. This case turns on a critical point. The state's removal of a Native American prospective juror based on reasons marked by misstatements in the record, shifting explanations, and speculation cannot withstand scrutiny under Batson's Step 3 analysis and compels a finding of clear error. Mr. Sangrew respectfully asks this court to vacate his conviction and order a new trial, or in the alternative, to remand this case for further proceedings under Batson. I'll focus the majority of my time this morning addressing the first issue, the denial of the Batson challenge, and I'll address issue two if there's time remaining, or of course if the court has any questions with regard to that issue. Now, the Supreme Court's landmark decision in Batson v. Kentucky recognized that even more subtle forms of discrimination undermine the integrity of the justice system. And it imposed a clear duty on courts to ensure that discrimination in peremptory challenges, that they are not used as a tool of exclusion. And the Batson line of cases reinforced two important points here. The first is that the peremptory challenge process is uniquely susceptible to being used as a vehicle for racial exclusion. And second, racial discrimination does not require racial animus. A strike made even on the mistaken belief that a juror will improperly favor a defendant because of their shared race is itself a form of racial discrimination under Batson. And the court instructed that the Constitution forbids the striking of even a single juror on account of race. Now, once a Batson challenge is raised and the defendant makes a prima facie case, enough facts giving rise to an inference of racial discrimination in step one, and the court...
We may be beyond that in this case.
Okay.
Maybe. But whether we are or we aren't, the question, Mr. Bloom, that I have is, what is there other than the strike itself and what we know about the juror's status as a Native American, what is there that would suggest that this was a strike founded upon or based upon his race?
Yeah, well, I think it starts with the fact Mr. Sangrew Jr. is a Native American, a cognizable racial group. The state used a peremptory strike on one of two Native American prospective jurors.
As I understand it, the defense also used a strike, peremptory strike, against a Native American as well, or at least that was said and no one corrected that. But in any event, but that really leaves us, and I interrupt you, I'm going to let you finish, I'm awfully sorry, but that just leaves us with the fact of the strike itself and the race. And I know these things aren't spelled out, and that's part of the work of the court to figure this out, but it seems like we just have a kind of an ipso facto argument here. Because this person was struck because they're Native American, we have a Batson challenge.
Well, and I think that's the starting point in the prima facie case, is that you have those two facts that have been recognized to satisfy the prima facie case. The Batson court noted that once those two requirements are met, that the defendant can rely upon the fact that the peremptory challenge process allows those who are of a mind to discriminate, And so it's an acknowledgement of the susceptibility that this has been and is a widespread issue and a reoccurring problem. Beyond that, we have Juror 78, who was responsive, who was actively volunteering answers, confirmed that he could be fair and impartial to both sides.
But of course, it wasn't a challenge for cause. And really, his qualifications as a good juror or not a good juror can't really figure into the any step, but certainly it wouldn't figure into the final analysis, would it?
Well, I think that, you know, the court is instructed to take in mind all of the relevant facts. You look at the total picture. And so when you do have a juror who is confirming his impartiality, that's a factor that the court takes in when they're assessing the credibility of the reasons proffered by the state.
And so and that's exactly what the court did. The court made a finding that the state had provided a race-neutral explanation, and we typically apply a very deferential review to that. What about this case suggests that that deferential review should result in us saying the circuit court got it wrong?
Yes. So it is a credibility assessment, and this court has indicated that it provides the court deference in its credibility assessment. But credibility is not simply based on the prosecutor's demeanor. This court has stated that that's one factor that can be looked at, but also the state's justifications and are they plausible? Do they hold up? Are they inconsistent? Are there indicators of pretext that indicate that these were not the real reasons, but they were actually pretext for racial exclusion?
And but didn't the circuit court take all that into account? All the same arguments were made before the circuit court.
So the circuit court did make a finding that the state's reasons were not pretext based on racial exclusion. And I acknowledge that this court has previously stated in Guth Miller, for example, that a trial court implicitly conducts the required analysis when it accepts or rejects the state's reasons. But here, there was evidence and indicators in the record that the trial court made an ultimate determination that was based on an incomplete recollection of the record. And one, I guess, example of that would be with regard to the court's oral findings on the record with regard to the state's lack of any follow-up questions to the juror with regard to his prior interaction with law enforcement. There, the court indicated there wasn't even a second question asked. But when you look at the record, there were some follow-up questions asked, one of which was, you know, anything about this situation that you would hold against the state in its case. The juror unequivocally answered no. The juror clarified that this was 20 years ago, that it was in a different county. None of the officers involved in that case were connected to this case. And the prosecutor even remarked that he would have only been 10 years old at the time, almost to emphasize how long ago this was. And so when the trial court said there was no second question asked, that indicates that it did not have the complete picture, and those were highly relevant factors in the step three analysis. The other indication that the analysis was incomplete was inherent in one of the stated reasons accepted by the court for the strike, and that was the possibility of criminal history is what the court found on the record. Now, inclusion of the word possibility, I think, demonstrates that the ultimate determination was based on some speculation. We had the criminal history sheet that belonged to the state, was provided to the defense, showed no criminal history at all for this.
But in this case, so when he answered that question, the juror 78, when he answered that question, he said that he was handcuffed, he was mistreated by the police and so on. I mean, could it be that the state just made a tactical decision not to really want to ask any more questions about that incident? I mean, they're not really required to. They don't want to. What if they don't want to poison the jury pool, for example?
Well, and that could be, but I think when you look at the actual back and forth discussion, you do see that the state did ask some questions, and you can see the prosecutor's sort of inconsequential treatment of the jurors' comments. And I think it certainly bears on the credibility issue that the state didn't even bring that up initially. They referred to it as comments on criminal history.
But since he himself said that he was handcuffed during that incident, I mean, is it that far of a stretch for the state to just say that, well, looks like he might have some criminal history, we're going to use a peremptory challenge without any racial animus whatsoever or motivation?
Well, I think
wouldn't they be allowed to do that?
I think under a different set of facts, that could certainly be a possibility, but I think the record here shows that the comments themselves were described as criminal history. The prosecutor admitted to having a difficult time understanding what was said. I think that the characterization, the glaring mischaracterization of this as criminal history could also be interpreted.
What if the state had just accurately said, our problem with him is that he's had a negative interaction with law enforcement in the past?
If the reasons had been consistent throughout, of course that's applicable to the step three analysis, and that could change how the court looks at this. But it should also be kept in mind that the prosecutor described this as a known criminal history. He had even looked this up beforehand. But then when asked what this criminal history was, the prosecutor couldn't even provide a vague description.
There was a questionnaire. There was a juror questionnaire, and the court ultimately looked at the questionnaire as well. It said, where juror 78 had said that he had a criminal history that was more than just speeding violations or traffic tickets or something like that. So he indicated he had something that was more than, more serious than whatever, traffic violations or something like that. So there just seemed to be some support for that.
Yeah. And I think you look at the criminal history sheet that showed no criminal history whatsoever, and so that raises the question, what is this? Is it a class 2 misdemeanor from 25 years ago? Prosecutor didn't know.
Presuming that there's some waffling, it seems to me that you're indicating there was some waffling here, shifting explanations. Ultimately, under step three, it's up to the trial court to determine credibility. And the trial court did determine credibility. Where did the trial court go wrong then? I mean, under our deferential standard of review, what do we look at?
Well, I think one of the things that I previously brought up was the lack of follow-through questioning, the incomplete recollection of the record. You look at
That's stepping back. I mean, the voir dire is done. We're now at the peremptory stage, and the judge has received these explanations and makes a credibility finding under step three that is not a pretext. Where did the judge go wrong for us to overrule her?
Well, I think by reading the record, you can see that there was a lack of clarity from the court on the state's reasons. Having to ask the prosecutor to restate its reasons because of all the variation and inconsistencies. And without reading back the record, I think it would have been difficult, if not impossible, to really appreciate the sequencing and the variation of the statements. And under Batson, these were really important factors to review to really assess, were these the real reasons or were they pretext for racial discrimination?
So similar to what Justice Myron asked, if the prosecutor right there on the spot would have had the words right there on the tip of his tongue to say, you know what, this man claims to have had a substantiated incident of law enforcement misconduct that victimized him, and it was substantiated. He has an adverse, I'm worried he'll have an adverse reaction to the law enforcement witnesses in this case just because they belong to that class of people there. Would that be race neutral?
I think that would be a very different set of facts, an explanation to look at. And I think in this case, with the shifting explanations, with the lack of clarity, and it is important in Miller L. v. Dredke, the court in very similar scenarios found that these shifting explanations reeked of afterthought, and it ignored the pretextual timing of the stated reasons for the strike. But I do think that when you look at the record, at one point the court did say we can read back the record, but then allow the prosecutor to state that one of the initial reasons was the negative interaction with police. And so I think the record reflects that the court did not carefully assess how these explanations evolved, and those were necessary in conducting this analysis. And I see my time is up, so I'll close.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hanke, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Justice Salter, you started this argument off asking Mr. Bluin, what evidence or what was out there that suggests that the state strike of juror number 78 was racially motivated or racially related? And there isn't any other than the fact that they are both members of the same minority group. When we look at, when we think about racially motivated strikes, typically there's like a pattern of the state striking minorities. In past cases, we've seen where the court or where the state would strike a large amount or a large pool of the minority group. Or
kind of hard to do that when there's only two on the prospective panel, right?
Two that we know of, Your Honor. As the state had pointed out, you don't necessarily know who is a member of that group.
So are we supposed to assume that there were more? I mean, how do you establish a pattern when, as far as everyone knows, there's only two members of the sort of suspect group involved?
So pattern can be certainly one of the things we look at. Some of the other things we look at is like suggestive questioning and whether or not like the state's questioning had some racially related undertones, giving them a reason for that strike. And here, there was simply nothing else to suggest that this was racially motivated. When we look at the rationale the state gave, it's been classified as shifting explanations, but I would submit to you that it's not. When the state responded to the Batson challenge, it indicated it was based in part because of the juror's criminal history. And when corrected by opposing counsel said, oh, I don't remember him talking about criminal history during voir dire. He talked about this negative interaction with law enforcement. And the state said, yes, I assumed they were related. Justice Kaczynski, you kind of hit on that a little bit, where the individual admitted to being thrown to the ground, handcuffed. And so it's not a far stretch for an individual to think that because the juror was handcuffed, it was related to his criminal history.
That one got cleared up pretty quickly. The prosecutor rerailed that right away and said, yes, what the defense lawyer said, that's what I'm talking about.
Correct. And that was consistent throughout the entire back and forth, if you will, with the court. The state never wavered from this negative interaction with law enforcement. I understand he may have classified it a little bit differently in his initial response, but that was the underlying reason throughout his entire presentation to the court. It was never changing or, you know, suggesting an afterthought. It was consistent throughout this negative interaction.
Kind of. I mean, it was, there's the idea that there was a negative experience with law enforcement officers for Juror 78, which may or may not involve criminal history, particularly if you take Juror 78 at his word and he says, yeah, it was actually substantiated. They shouldn't have done whatever they did to him, handcuffed him, that sort of thing. So then that kind of gets, you know, swamped around with criminal history. And this is the imprecision that Mr. Bluin's arguing about. And so the question really is, you know, if you do have maybe in objectively something that's race neutral, could the state snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory by failing to articulate it well enough and being clear enough, and would that ever create clear error, or could it in this case?
Could it ever create a clear error? I mean, maybe if the state is more wishy-washy or not very articulate, but in this case, the state was articulate in its rationale. Like I said, it really kept to the negative interaction with law enforcement.
I asked Mr. Bluen about our deferential standard on a court's decision like this, and one of the things he suggested that might overcome that deference is the fact that the court seems to have misapprehended some of the circumstances of the juror's background.
Yes, Your Honor. So in terms of the court misremembering the record, so to speak, the court was present throughout the entirety of voir dire. It was also present, obviously, for the argument made by the state. And whether or not it remembered, the state followed up. You know, the court said, well, the state didn't follow up, but it did. And so in reality, because the state followed up, I think that actually rules more in favor of the state, because the state did have follow-up questions to that negative interaction. It wasn't just, oh, you had a negative interaction, okay, let's move on to the next question. And so...
But the court also seemed to have some genuine concerns about the explanations and the way the state was making its explanations, and then perhaps seemed to maybe in the end say, well, it's a close call, so I give it to the state, sort of thing.
Ultimately, the circuit court did what it was supposed to do in this case, and it evaluated the explanations and determined that a race-neutral explanation was given. And part of that is credibility of the state in terms of its rationale explained. And the court did its analysis in here. I know this court has seen a couple cases in the past where the circuit court kind of bypasses prong three of the Batson challenge or analysis. And that's not what happened here. The court did a full analysis, and it appropriately found the state's rationale was non-racially motivated.
Can you back up just a little bit on, I think for the first time on appeal, you make the argument that there was no prima facie case presented. Is that waived because it was never made down below?
It is, Your Honor, but I still stand by that there was no prima facie showing. I think there does need to be more than the jurors struck and the defendant belonged to the same minority group.
Do you get to raise that with us if you didn't raise it below?
No. This issue was not raised below in terms of whether or not the prima facie showing was made.
So it's really not something we can address either, because it wasn't preserved below.
Correct, Your Honor. There was also some discussion with Mr. Bluen about the state, or I should say, juror number 78 was rehabilitated during voir dire, saying, you know, this instance was 20 years ago. I can sit fair and impartially. I can weigh the evidence. But he was rehabilitated for a for-cause challenge. It would not have been appropriate to challenge him for a for-cause challenge based on that. However, when it comes to preemptory strikes, we do not have such a stringent guideline. In fact, the parties are pretty welcome to strike a juror for whatever reason they see fit, obviously racially neutral reasons, I should say. And so the fact that the juror said he could sit there and remain impartial does not mean that the state doesn't have a worry that the juror could still have some inherent biases against the state based on his prior interactions. And then I realize Mr. Bluen didn't get to issue two, but if the court would indulge me for just a brief moment with what little time I have left. The state did not engage in prosecutorial misconduct in its closing arguments in this case. The phrase "we know" was used to marshal in evidence admitted at trial and the reasonable inferences that from that evidence, which does not equate to improper vouching. When the state used the phrase "we know," it was merely reciting evidence that was presented at trial. And the state is allowed to highlight inconsistencies throughout its closing argument, which is the purpose of closing argument, is to point out inconsistencies and show what the evidence showed.
Yeah, this went a little bit beyond just highlighting evidence. There's multiple times where the prosecutor says, "We know this, we know this." You know, for instance, "We know the intent. We know he intended to cause her death. We know the result is guilty of murder in the first degree." Those are pretty strong statements on this evidence. And does that cross the line?
They are strong statements, Your Honor, but no, they don't cross the line when you read them in the entirety of the closing argument. That was kind of what I would consider a more of a closing, if you will. The state was wrapping up its closing argument and gone through what all of the evidence showed and was just really kind of hammering it home at the end.
But we know it seems to express an opinion more than just a, you know, the evidence shows this, the evidence shows his intent, and here's why, the evidence, as opposed to "we know." I know as the prosecutor, and you know as the juror now, because I'm conveying that to you and telling you, you should know based on this evidence.
But again, I think when you look at the totality of the argument, the phrase "we know" was used quite frequently, and there was no suggestion that the state had knowledge that a jury did not. It was simply a way to present the evidence without some sort of passive or clunky phrase that "I submit to the evidence shows."
Mr. Blewin cites a number of federal cases where the courts have been looked very disfavorably at using words like that rather than simply conveying the evidence and saying this evidence would convince you that he did this.
He does, and this court has also said recently in the Here decision that the state shouldn't be expected to use passive voice the entire time or to use "I submit to you." So long that it is clear the state is arguing from evidence presented, it isn't improper.
So isn't sort of the key launch point for this area the initial determination about who is we, right? Because if we is law enforcement and the cops and we know it and mm-hmm. I'm telling you mm-hmm. that, you've got a real problem. Mm-hmm. What if we is the collective group that heard the evidence?
That is how I interpreted when I read the closing argument. Collective group in the courtroom, so to speak.
So we can't really necessarily have a categorical rule that says we is always bad. The
Correct.
Pronoun, the collective pronoun, plural pronoun, we is bad. It seems to depend upon the context a little bit, or a lot.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I think context is very important. And like I said, when I read through the closing, I interpreted it as the collective we, where the state was talking about himself and the jury. We sat through this trial together. This is what the evidence shows us.
Isn't that kind of a problem, though? Doesn't that get pretty close, maybe even crosses the line of the golden rule when the prosecutor puts himself in the jury or vice versa?
I wouldn't say in this instance the prosecutor put himself in the role of the juror. It simply stated what the evidence was that was presented and the inferences that can be drawn from that.
You said when you read the transcript, that's how you felt about it. But to me, the question is, how would the jury view it when the state says to them, "We know he's lying"?
Again, Your Honor, I think it depends on the context. And like I said, in this context, it seems that it was more the collective we, as in the jury, not collective we, the prosecution team and the witnesses. Because the circuit court properly denied defendant's Batson challenge and the state's closing argument did not constitute improper vouching, the state respectfully requests this court to affirm Shangru's judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Blum, you may proceed with rebuttal.
thank you.
On that second issue, assume we determine this crossed the line.
Yes.
What, talk about prejudice.
Yeah. Certainly, you know, with the statement, for example, we know he's guilty of first-degree murder. I understand that the jury ultimately found Mr. Shangaroo not guilty on that count, but I don't think it necessarily resolves the question of whether the prosecutor's we know statements influenced the jury's evaluation of Mr. Shangaroo's mental state. The prosecutor said, we know his intent. We know he meant to cause death. We know he probably lied on the stand. Of course, I think intent in this case was certainly a key issue, a close issue in this case. There was certainly evidence in the record that Mr. Shangaroo had a hard time understanding what was happening around him, the staggering, the yelling out for his girlfriend, banging on a window in the parking lot, extremely intoxicated, described by one witness as not things that he was saying were not making sense, trying to help EM off the bathroom floor. So I think it was a close question on intent, and I do think it crossed the line.
So if the state had said instead in its arguments, you know, instead of we know, wouldn't be a problem, correct?
I think that would be different, yes.
And so it's really about the context of we and how we is interpreted in these circumstances. And so what is it about this particular use of the word we that makes this one problematic?
Well, because these were on ultimate issues that are squarely within the province of the jury, and it's interjecting, I believe, a personal opinion or conclusion on these facts that were not known facts, and saying, you know, it really, I guess, improperly places the prestige of the government behind the assessment of the credibility, the intent, the ultimate guilt. And in that way, I think it did cross the line here.
Do you agree that this issue was forfeited?
Forfeited.
There was no contemporaneous objection. There was no objection whatsoever. So we would review it really only under plain error.
That's correct.
And we really only get to prejudice, which would be prong three, the substantial rights determination. If there's one, an error, so let's say using we was not good. Two, it's plain. It's plain as day under the rules as they exist. Is there a rule that you can point to that says, this one is so darn clear the judge should have corrected it on its own, even without an objection? Is there that kind of a rule?
Well, I think if the prosecutor interjects his own conclusions, that this court in State v. Beck indicated that that error is plain. And I think that that's what happened here. And so I do think it was plain error.
I'll take you back to prejudice for one more moment. The chief asked that about it, and I kind of diverted you from it. So what about our traditional analysis is it made a difference? How do we assess that this made some difference? Without this error, without the state making these?
Yeah, and I think you have to look at the issue of intent and how close the evidence was on that issue, and whether that could have impacted the jury's decision related to intent, even if it meant the difference between, for example, manslaughter in the first degree versus murder in the second degree, that would be a different result. And so I think that the jury could possibly have been improperly influenced by those statements made by the prosecutor, and that it did make a difference in the result. I see my time is winding down here. I would just close in saying, taken together on the first issue, the circumstantial evidence of pretext and the state's reasons cannot be explained away by mistakes or coincidences. The numerous signs of pretext here were present, and the circumstantial evidence establishes that the reasons for the strike were pretextual. In the alternative, the trial court did not adequately examine the accuracy or plausibility of the state's reasons. And for that reason, we are asking this court to vacate Mr. Shangru's conviction and remand for new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is fully submitted. We'll be in recess till 9:45.